was indeed a neurological issue, a brain network disorder.
A possible explanation for alleged sonic attacks in China. It's Monday, September 3rd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, controversy and conundrum for Google in China. Climate change, a concern in the Pacific. Korean farming grows in Africa. Virtual reality medicine and eco-friendly cows. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Doctors and scientists are now saying that unconventional weapons, possibly using microwaves, may have caused the symptoms and ailments reported by U.S. diplomats and their family members in Cuba and China. Initial results of some earlier research did not result in any substantial causes of the apparent attacks. At the request of the U.S. government, a medical team at the University of Pennsylvania examined many of the affected diplomats. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Douglas Smith, the study's lead author and director of the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Pennsylvania.
We were contacted by the State Department to take a look at this patient cohort, and so we agreed. I put together a team of experts in different disciplines, all around concussion type of treatment and evaluation, because that's what we surmise what the symptoms appeared like. And we learned pretty early on that while some patients were in contact with each other, others were not. So if it were mass hysteria, in theory, everything would have to be kind of cross-pollinated or contaminated, that they'd share stories and develop a kind of a scenario and a kind of a storyline. But that was not the case here. So there are individuals who did not know what the other individuals were experiencing as far as symptoms. The other important thing is that these symptoms are kind of complex. So this is very much like concussion. We sometimes call it concussion without the concussion, meaning that these individuals had no history of a head impact and yet displayed very similar symptoms to somebody who has persisting concussion difficulties. And that's things like, troubles with cognition, how quickly they think, how they can remember words, can come up with a word, as well as balance and visual problems that were very characteristic of this group. Now, some of those tests you can't actually fake. Whether it was conscious or subconscious, you can't fake some of these types of tests on the neurological exam. So one by one, independently, the specialists examining this patient group were convinced, and it's uniformly across everyone in our group, that this was indeed a neurological issue, a brain network disorder, and not a psychogenic type of change that originated because of some kind of mass hysteria type of event.
This has been reported, at least over the past couple of days, as being some kind of microwave attack. Did you confirm that?
No, we did not confirm that. So I think the New York Times ran a piece that seemed like a primary suspect to us. But on our side, we're not really the energy people. So we are aware of an extensive literature that where people have used different types of energies and directed them at the brains of animals in experimental studies, and find that almost everything they test does cause a brain injury. And the list is not really long, and microwaves are on that list as part of a radio frequency exposure.
Are you aware of any such weapons, or whatever you would like to call it, that are in existence?
I don't know of those things. I think we're all aware of, maybe microwave type of beams that could take down a drone or some kind of aircraft, and there are weapons that maybe could cause pain with microwaves, a burning sensation, which was not the case for this patient cohort. So again, this is not my area of expertise, but a lot of the energy sources there always seems to be some kind of problem. From a medical perspective, we would be very curious of why it's selectively the brain and not peripheral nerves. Not tissue outside of the brain.
Is this damage uniform enough among your sample to come to the conclusion that a certain type of weapon or something that was similar, both in Cuba and China and maybe elsewhere, has been used?
We are currently evaluating what we call advanced neuroimaging to look at these brain pathways to see if there is a signature type of change in the brain. We're also joining with the National Institutes of Health to have what we call replication studies, so they can also look at the clinical data and neuroimaging to see if they concur and that we can work together on looking forward of developing what we would call an operational diagnostic criteria that we could, based on these different pieces of evidence, determine the specific signature of this this newfound disorder. And finally, we're working with the Canadians as well, who have some cases there, so that we can compare notes between the findings in our cohort of Americans and their group of Canadians. I think that what we really need is to further the studies and try to understand what kind of exposure can cause changes in the brain that look very similar to what we see with concussion, and yet not the head blow. In other words, what kind of, let's call it mechanical forces, can change the brain in a way that's ultimately very similar to a head blow, but there is no evidence of having that very large mechanical injury?
Dr. Douglas Smith, the study's lead author and director of the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Pennsylvania, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. A State Department official told VOA the health and well-being of our personnel remains our top priority. The investigation into the origin of these symptoms continues. The interagency community is working diligently to determine the cause of the symptoms, as well as to develop mitigation strategies. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Amid U.S. trade war, China's Xi reiterates reform commitment. The United Nations says number of people in China re-education camps could top 1 million. Mother and daughter speak up to prevent child marriage in Bangladesh. Australian Catholic secrecy stance could provoke clashes. In Bangkok, rice field farmer in no hurry to sell. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also visit our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A group of 14 rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, has appealed to the giant search engine Google not to re-enter the Chinese market amid reports it is preparing to launch a censored version 8 years after leaving the country. In their open letter to Google CEO Sundar Pichai, they warned a reversal of position would represent an alarming capitulation by accommodating what they call one of the world's most repressive internet censorship and surveillance regimes. In 2006, Google attempted to comply with China's censorship rules, but left the market in 2010. Now there are reports a new version of its search engine is being developed, codenamed Dragonfly, designed to be compatible with China's stringent laws and regulations. Human Rights Watch Asia Director Brad Adams tells VOA's Victor Beatty it appears Google is prepared to sacrifice its stated goal of giving as much information as possible to as many people as possible.
And they're sacrificing the idea of a free and open internet. Once you make a compromise with one of the world's global powers, you're going to end up in a lowest common denominator scenario where China will become the new normal for many countries around the world. Google has market power and the following to say no to China, and therefore to say no to other smaller countries that don't have the same kind of leverage that China appears to now have over Google. So Google was able to do things like move its servers out of China to ensure that it was not ever subject to Chinese laws and then therefore Chinese orders to turn over material that they wouldn't turn over, for instance, in the United States. So we're going to have dueling internets. We're going to have a free internet for democracies, which will probably be slightly eroded over time as more authoritarian governments in the West try to argue that they should have the same access to information as China or the same right to censor. And then we'll have a highly regulated, controlled internet in China and other dictatorships.
Of course, Google hasn't confirmed its plans yet, but it's certainly a lucrative market, so it can hardly avoid not going back.
Google is already fabulously profitable. Its founders, Sergey Brin, who is a Russian immigrant, Larry Page, are gazillionaires. They have more money than anyone could ever spend in their lives. They do not need to make the extra money in China either as a corporation or as individuals. And they're sacrificing their principles and their reputation for, you know, as my family would say, a few shekels. And that doesn't make any sense. There's just no good reason to make this compromise because they already are dominant in the world, not in China, but dominant in the rest of the world. And there is no sign that, for instance, the Chinese search engines were going to displace Google anywhere else in the world anytime soon.
Is this a message also to other internet companies who want to do business in China?
Google has stood out and sort of held a line that some internet companies have tried to follow, and we could cite the Google standard to Microsoft, Yahoo, Cisco, and other companies that have made compromises in China, and they have been very uneasy, very defensive, and have always tried to point out the ways in which they tried to maintain control over their servers, to maintain user privacy, and to do as little censorship as possible. But, of course, that goal, that ideal that Google has set will now be lost.
Brad Adams said minutes of a meeting Sundar Pichai had with Google employees last week have been leaked and indicate a sizable number opposed to the reported move. He said many joined because of Google's founding motto, "Don't be evil." He said the company stands to lose a lot of good employees if it decides to re-enter the Chinese internet market, which he said is more censorious than ever. Happening now in Asia, Pakistan has dismissed as incorrect reports the United States has canceled $300 million in military aid to the country, saying Washington owed the money for expenses incurred on fighting terrorism. The controversy comes days before Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits the South Asian nation. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us and starting out your brand new week with us on VOA Asia. One of the South Pacific's longest-serving leaders has said that climate change is an existential threat to island nations. Samoa's prime minister has told a meeting in Australia that any world leader who denies the existence of climate change should be taken to a psychiatric facility. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Rising sea levels and erosion are threatening low-lying communities in the South Pacific. Some small islands have already disappeared in what many islanders consider to be the first signs that climate change has the power to overwhelm vulnerable areas. Speaking at the Lowy Institute, an independent think tank in Sydney, Samoa's Prime Minister Tualaipe Sailele urged Australia to make deeper cuts to its carbon emissions to help protect Pacific Island nations. Australia is still highly dependent on coal for power generation and has some of the world's highest per capita levels of greenhouse gas pollution. Sailele said that warming temperatures pose an existential challenge to low-lying islands. He also criticised world leaders who deny the science of climate change.
We all know the solutions, and all that is left would be some political courage, some political guts. And any leader of those countries who believes that there is no climate change, I think he ought to be taken to a mental confinement. He is utter stupid.
The long-serving Samoan leader also said that Australia's attitudes to the South Pacific had been patronising and said despite China's growing diplomatic and commercial influence, the independence and autonomy of regional states should be respected. The Prime Minister's governing Human Rights Protection Party won a landslide victory in a parliamentary election in March 2016. The result confirmed Sailele's fifth term as leader. Samoa has a population of about 200,000 people. The archipelago was governed by New Zealand until a vote for independence in 1961. The mainstays of the economy are fishing and agriculture. Samoa lies about halfway between Hawaii and New Zealand in the South Pacific Ocean. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, South Korea's African farming legacy. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Police in central China have detained 46 people who were part of a protest against a government plan to address overcrowded classrooms that escalated into violence. Police in the city of Luoyang in Hunan province say officers dispersed around 600 protesters who had gathered outside the local police station. Gather daily for the latest stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, South Koreans have left an agricultural legacy in Africa as young people are returning to farms in South Sudan to empower themselves through food production. The country has been devastated by 5 years of conflict, which has left the agricultural sector struggling to feed the nation. Faith Lapidus reports on a vocational center teaching the new farmers skills to help them fill that need.
It's harvest time at the Hanbit Agricultural Training Center. It was established in 2015 by South Korean peacekeepers of the UN mission in Bor, South Sudan. The students are enrolled in a 3-month course to learn the skills they'll need to run a profitable farm business.
It is something good because the knowledge that we have acquired here, we are going to do it there in the community. Because when we will be delivered here, we are going to open up our farms, we dig and we cultivate our crops. Therefore, if we sold those crops, we are going to earn money. And that is a self-employment.
The students have cultivated a fast-growing species of maize and a variety of other crops, including celery and cucumbers. They learned irrigation technologies and how to set up greenhouses.
Now we are farmers. We planted some crops that gave us a good yield. It's not like before. The peacekeepers have really helped us here in South Sudan. With this training, we can help develop South Sudan. Each of us will go and farm in different villages and counties to help building the country.
Aid groups say almost two-thirds of South Sudanese will need food aid this year to stave off starvation and malnutrition blamed on famine and the civil war.
Conflict only brought poverty, but agriculture can bring welfare of the people. You can see that the communities are now working together here in Hanbit. So it's a sign that working together as a community in through agriculture can eradicate conflicts and hunger at the same time.
The Hanbit Agricultural Training Center was established to build vocational skills, facilitate development, and foster reconciliation. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia, President Joko Widodo says Indonesia will bid to host the 2032 Olympics, following the success of the Asian Games held in Jakarta and Palembang over the last 2 weeks. International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach welcomed the candidacy of Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous nation. Visit VOA Asia Facebook, which always hosts the most interesting stories. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, more than 100 hospitals across the United States are using virtual reality as a form of therapy for patients to help manage symptoms such as pain and anxiety. An increasing number of countries worldwide are taking an interest in VR, and doctors are starting to develop international guidelines on how to apply and validate it in healthcare. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on a digital medicine leader in Los Angeles.
Amanda Green lives with pain.
If I don't have nerve pain, I might have joint pain. If I'm not having joint pain, I might have headaches.
The unrelenting pain is a symptom of lupus, an autoimmune disease where a patient's own immune system attacks the body. She participated in a study to see how VR can help with pain.
It worked. It works for me.
VR creates a distraction for her pain, and the content teaches her breathing techniques that also helps.
If it helps with the pain or not.
Brennan Spiegel, a gastroenterologist at Cedars-Sinai, says VR is more than just distraction.
Whoa.
He heads the hospital's virtual reality program.
Abdominal pain, discomfort, GI symptoms, in some cases are related to mental state. The brain and the gut are constantly communicating. Something like virtual reality actually can intercede in the brain-gut axis and sort of rewire the neural circuitry in a way that helps to reduce abdominal pain. Virtual reality can reduce pain, can reduce blood pressure, and now we're looking to see, can it do really important things like reduce the need for opioids.
But could VR also be addictive?
We have not seen abuse amongst our patients who are using it for therapeutic purposes.
Spiegel is now taking virtual reality outside the hospital to partner clinics such as Attune Health, where many of the patients suffer from joint pain.
We're not just using it as a distraction method, but we are trying to train our patients in deep breathing and biofeedback.
The company Applied VR is developing content to have a VR pharmacy.
You need a wide variety of content because you have a wide variety of people in healthcare. You have every from, you know, infancy to geriatrics.
The aim is for patients to learn in virtual reality how to use their minds to manage pain and reproduce these skills in the real world. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Researchers worldwide have been searching for ways to reduce cattle emissions with various food additives. Dairy farms and other livestock operations are a major source of methane, a heat-trapping gas that contributes to global warming. Now, University of California researchers are feeding seaweed to dairy cows in an attempt to make the cattle more climate-friendly. VOA's Deborah Block has the story.
This is breakfast for these cows on a dairy farm at the University of California, Davis. They are getting an additional unusual ingredient in their food, seaweed.
We mix it with molasses, so it's a nice little sweet treat for them. We try to mix it as well as we can into their feed, but we have some cows that'll pick it out, and we have some cows that'll go right for the seaweed.
The researchers are studying whether small amounts of seaweed to cattle feed can help reduce the livestock's emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that's released when they burp, pass gas, or make manure. A dozen cows were fed ocean algae, which was mixed into their feed. Before feeding the seaweed to the cows, the researchers test it in this lab, where they can measure emissions in fermenters that simulate cattle stomachs.
And what we have basically here is six individual guts, and we can run them in parallel, and we can test the effect of different feed additives on the gut microbiology.
Milk samples are also tested for flavor and nutritional value. And the methane content of the cow's breath is measured when they stick their heads into these feeding machines. The researchers discovered that methane emissions were reduced by more than 30%.
And so far, it's very encouraging.
Dairy farms and other livestock operations are major sources of methane, and California is requiring them to cut those emissions by 40% by 2030.
Reducing methane ultimately means reducing greenhouse gases and reducing the impacts of climate change. So it affects everybody in the globe.
More studies are needed to determine the safety and effectiveness of the seaweed feed. Deborah Block, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online. You can download us from iTunes and SoundCloud. You can stream us on VOA Asia Facebook and, of course, our website at voanews.com. And as always, we want to hear from you. Contact us on Facebook or send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We'd like to thank everyone listening on the radio, PSU, Radio Patani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We appreciate you tuning in today. We always appreciate our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.